Welcome back to the Lyme Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander. This is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's conversation is with the beautiful and very brilliant Dr. Ellen Langer. Dr. Ellen Langer is an American professor of psychology at Harvard University. In 1981, she became the first woman ever to be tenured in psychology at Harvard. She's also known as the mother of mindfulness. She just wrote her, I believe this is her fifth book, referred to as The Mindful Body. And this conversation is all about the mind-body relationship, psychosomatics, and just how our thoughts, feelings, perceptions of the world, perceptions of ourselves inform our physiology and how that works in verse as well. Dr. Ellen is just so hilarious, and she's like, I really enjoy having conversations with her. I think this might be our second, perhaps even third conversation. She knocks my socks off every time. She busts my balls every time. And I think you guys are going to really enjoy the banter in this conversation. So let's get to it with my gal, Dr. Ellen Langer. Thank you guys for subscribing to this to get each week's episodes. Thanks for leaving us reviews. I read all of them. Let's get to it with my gal, Dr. Ellen Langer.
All right, Ellen, I appreciate you. Thank you for coming back.
Recording. My pleasure.
We're back in it. So you have a new book.
I have a new book, like The Mindful Body, Thinking Our Way to Chronic Health. And it's very exciting. It's interesting, Aaron. The book started as a memoir and then morphed into what it is now, which is similar to the mindfulness book, but with lots and lots of personal stories. And so one which was important to the whole essence of the book, which is about mind-body unity, was a story about my ex-husband, not about him personally, about us. So I was married when I was very young, and we went to Europe on our honeymoon, and I'm in Paris, and I'm very, very grown up, because after all, now I'm a married woman. So I ordered this mixed grill in this restaurant, and on the grill is pancreas. And I asked him, point out which of these things, because he was more sophisticated than I, which of these things is the pancreas? So he points to something. I'm a big eater. With gusto, I eat everything else on the plate. Now comes the moment of truth. Will I be able to eat the pancreas? I start eating it, and I'm literally getting sick. The sicker I'm getting, the bigger the smile on his face. And I say, what is so funny? He said, that's chicken. You ate the pancreas ages ago. Okay, so now it was many years later until the theory of mind-body unity was born, but that was the first. The second is very important, much more, it's both personal and more important than that little story, was my mother had cancer, breast cancer, and the cancer had metastasized to her pancreas. Well, as you know, that's the end game. Interestingly, at one point, magically, it was totally gone. And the medical world couldn't explain it. And the mind-body unity idea does explain it. So very simply, we have mind, body. We could have had mind, body, and elbows. That would give us different views of people. I say, these are just words. Let's put it all together. It's one thing. Mind and body, they're not connected. It's one thing. So wherever you're putting the mind, you're necessarily putting the body. And every thought you have will affect your health. Every move you make will affect your thoughts, and so on. So the first test of this, I know you know about, it was the counterclockwise study. And I can say this was a famous study because if you tune into The Simpsons Go to Havana, you get to see it. So you've made The Simpsons, you've made it.
Right? That's true. That's
for those few people who don't know that or don't watch The Simpsons, what we did was we retrofitted a retreat to 20 years earlier, and had people live there as if men, old men, live there as if they were their younger selves. So we spoke about, they saw movies, TV, discussion groups, all about things happening 20 years ago, but that they were going to respond to as if it was happening right now. As a result of this, with no medical intervention, we found their hearing improved, their vision improved, their strength improved, their memory improved, and they looked noticeably younger, all within a week. And so those findings were so extreme and important for me that I continued doing that work for the next 20 years. And The most recent of which, there's so many I can choose from on all different topics, but let me just take one, which was a study on wound healing. Now, it would have been nice for experimental purposes to really just, you know, hurt people, create a giant wound. I didn't want to do that. And even if I did, the review committee would not let me do it. So it's a minor wound, but a wound still. We have people all equally wounded, so to speak, in front of a clock. For a third of the people, the clock is going twice as fast as real time. Time is rushing by. For a third of the people, the clock is going half as fast as real time. For a third of the people, the clock is real time. So the question we're asking, is that wound going to heal when, quote, it's supposed to, when one would assume, you know, when real time tells us the amount of time has passed, or perceived time, what the clock tells us? And the answer was perceived time. We have so much more control over our health than people realize that do study after study, write book after book to try to get the story out there so people can start using all of this information to heal themselves, to keep themselves happy and well. You know, one of the, I know you know that the research on placebos is very exciting, research that I, but mostly other people have done. And I think placebos may be our strongest medicine. Now, you can't easily give yourself a placebo. You can't give yourself a pill and make believe it's real medicine when you know it's not real medicine, okay? But if you just think about a placebo, that you take this pill, the doctor tells you is going to cure you, and then you get cured, but the pill is inert, so it's not the pill. So who's doing the curing? You're doing it yourself. So we set out to try to give this self-healing to people more directly. And we've done this with many diseases, chronic diseases. We've done it with Parkinson's, stroke, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, chronic pain, and it's true for stress and depression as well, but many real big chronic illnesses. It's very simple. Let's say, I call you different times of the day, different days of the week, and I ask you a very simple question. First, how does it feel now? And is it better or worse than it was before? Then the important question, why? Well, three things happen with this. The first, once you see it's fluctuating, I mean, you thought you were in pain, the same pain killing you all the time. You see now, you know, sometimes it's not so bad. So then you feel a little better. Second, by looking for why now is it better or worse, you go on a mindful search, and over 40 years of my research has shown that mindfulness is good for your health and well-being. When you're mindful, noticing new things, the neurons are firing, and it's literally and figuratively enlivening. And third, I think you're more likely to find a solution if you're looking for one. And sadly, when people are told they have chronic illnesses, they assume there's nothing that can be done about them.
Yeah.
So we do this for sometimes just 2 weeks with people. It's not always so easy. But we've gotten positive results across all of those diseases. So if you think stress, people who are stressed think they're stressed all the time. No one is stressed all the time, right? The problem is, or I don't know if it's a problem, the reality is that when you're not stressed, you're not thinking about the stressor. So you go from being maximally stressed, not thinking about it, to stressed again, and you forget that intervening period was okay. But we bring your attention to it. So let's say, Aaron, we do this with you because you're maximally stressed, clearly. And you find that, you know, when I'm talking to Ellen Langer, that's when I'm the most stressed. Well, so then the cure is very easy. Stop talking to me, right? Yeah. So sometimes it's easier than other times, but this is has proven
or
to be...
Or change my relationship of what it means to talk to Ellen Langer.
Exactly. That's what I would prefer because I would hate it if we never spoke anymore. It would just destroy my day.
So you are a Harvard professor. You're well-respected within the academic world. I imagine you're probably quite contentious within the academic world as well.
No, but you mean I'm not respected in the non-academic world? That's
well, just
sad.
In that space, I think that space, it's easy to turn a nose up to any folks that's not within that club. I presume.
I don't pay attention to those people, so I don't know what they think.
Yeah, but within that, I wonder what would your perception be of from a more of like a reductionist materialistic lens? What is happening when a person perceives time is moving faster and suddenly they are upregulating their healing response to match that time, or i.e. kind of like the way that our thoughts and feelings and perceptions, like epigenetics is kind of, it seems like it's like bridging into that type of conversation, how our thoughts and perceptions could affect our physiology.
Well, you see, you're still speaking of it as if the mind and the body are connected.
I'm trying to bridge the gap and to be able to bridge both worlds of language into like, could we break it down? Step one, two, three, what's happening with your genetics or your cells or cytokines? Like, what's like the objective language for this?
Yeah, I don't know an objective language or even a subjective language. Look, you know, if I raise my hand 2 inches, every part of my body is different. And people don't realize that. I think that what I've intentionally done is not attend to the very things you seem to find most interested in, because for me, the interesting thing is to see how far I can push this. So let's say, for example, many, many years ago, I was on the Division on Aging at Harvard Medical School. And I called Jack Rowe, who was the chair of them. And I said, Jack, how long does it take for a broken finger to heal? So he said, well, I don't know, a week. I said, okay, what would you do? What would you say if I said I could heal it in 6 days? He said, all right. I said, what about 5 days? He said, sure. 4 days? No. I said, okay, what about three days and 23 hours? You know, what is the point where here you can and here you can't? And I want to push it, you know, and if you go deeply enough, which you're likely to do, at least when we get off, you know, you'd say I'm talking about instant healing. And in some sense, you know, yes. Sure. But, you know, when we have a study now, we don't have any data on it yet, but I would be shocked if it didn't work, where we take people who've broken, let's say, their arms or legs, whatever. And typically you go to the doctor and they do what they do, and then they tell you how long it's going to take to heal. And so what we're doing is we take one group and let them get that information. And we take another group and we give them the fastest healing time that's ever been known. And the assumption is people will heal a lot faster. What people don't realize is that all of the numbers we're given hide all the ambiguity. You know, that there are people who are not getting sick. There are people who are getting sick for a long time. And that what determines where on this continuum you fall, and what I'm saying, and I know that you yourself believe this and write about this, that we can determine pretty much the trajectory for ourselves, our own illnesses.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like have you looked into, or maybe you've been involved in some of the research with multiple personality disorder? Disorder might not be the best term for it.
No. It's interesting. In my mindfulness book, I actually talk about some of that because and I don't know if this has been found to remain true or has been questioned, but at that time, which was many decades ago, the data were such that when you were one of those personalities, your physiology, not just your overt behavior, was in line with that personality. So let's say you had a passive personality and an aggressive personality, that all of the underlying physiology matched and differed depending on who you were at the moment, which fits perfectly with this mind-body unity idea.
Yeah, so it seems like there's so much value in our self-identity structure, like the construct that we believe ourselves to be, which is quite biblical, it's like if you want new information, look into old books.
A
lot of this is like, oh yeah, this is kind of like, first there was the word and our thoughts and all that
but
stuff.
But then people forgot all of reality. That. You know, right? Yeah. Before Descartes gave us mind-body unity, mind-body dichotomy, there must have been a mind-body unity. And so I'm saying, let's go back.
Go on. Well, I was going to say, if you were teaching someone to sculpt a sculpture, like a physical sculpture, you could probably give them some tips on how to do so. Is there some way to sculpt one's structure of self or perceived self in a way that actually has been shown to work, or something that you find to be helpful?
Well, I wrote a book on becoming an artist, thinking our way to mindful creativity. And essentially that it's the same... the different subject matter, but essentially the same theme pops up no matter what I write, where we are limiting ourselves by our expectations, by our mindsets. And so, I said in this new book, essentially we want to put people back in the equation and say, who decided that? So when you say, I teach you to sculpt, or you teach yourself to sculpt, and is it any good? Well, where do those criteria come from?
Right.
And people use the criteria and then they won't do it, or they become disparaged by other people. I mentioned in the On Becoming book that the Impressionist paintings that we pay millions and millions of dollars for today, if we wanted to buy one, were rejected back in their day. They couldn't get into an art show. So the idea is, always question the context. And that's what I was saying when I asked you to add 1 + 1, that everything changes, everything depends on context and the way we're looking at it. And, there's a large part of the book where I talk about decision-making and mindful decision-making, because people seem to have so much trouble making decisions and they get so stressed. And I believe stress is the major cause of illness. I think it's more important than genetics, nutrition. And stress is psychological. So if we can conquer that, we've got the game beaten. In order to have stress, you need two things. You need to believe something's going to happen, and when it happens, it's going to be awful. Well, prediction is an illusion. We're very good looking back and what is it called, Monday morning quarterbacking. But going forward, anything could happen. I could continue talking and I could fall off the chair that I'm on. You don't know. I could start to cough. My computer, just like your computer a little while ago, could disconnect us. So we know going forward that we don't know. But when something happens and we're looking at things from the past, we make a nice, easy path to it and think we should know. When you recognize that you can't predict, then the whole game of decision-making makes no sense, right? Yeah. Should I choose A or B? Well, I don't know if anything could happen, and A is not necessarily going to be the A that I knew and loved way back when. I did this thing with a decision-making class at Harvard. I said to them, okay, I have been teaching a version of this class for, 35 years, and I never missed a class. What is the likelihood that I'm going to be here next week? So we go around the room, and these are Harvard students, so they're a little bizarre. It's very smart, sweet, but bizarre. And the first one says 97%. How are they doing a calculation to come up? So they all give these silly answers, basically all saying they're 100% sure that I'm going to be there. Good. Now I say, I want to go around the room again, and I want each of you to give me a good reason why I won't be here. Invariably, the first one says, well, you've always been here. You deserve the time off. The next one says your dog had to go to the vet. The next one said you had a flat. We get 16 good answers. And I say, okay, what is the likelihood I'm going to be here next week? And now that 100% drops to 50%. We just don't know. And that's okay. It's scary for some people. It's scary for some people to recognize the inherent uncertainty in everything. Until you realize that events don't have a valence. That is, good things and bad things don't happen. Things happen. And those things we interpret. And if you interpret it as bad, your life is going to be unhappy. You interpret it as good. So Aaron, you and I don't know why I keep using this is such a silly example, but you and I go out to lunch and the food is wonderful. Yay, wonderful. We made all sorts of good decisions.
Is this a date?
Yeah, it's whatever you want it to be.
All right, we're going on a date.
And it's a fancy restaurant. Nice. And I'm paying.
Are you paying?
Right, yes, well, I am. Okay. Okay.
So it's 2023, baby.
Right, okay. And the food is wonderful. So it seems that all the decisions going into that were wonderful, right? Now, if the food is awful, for me, it'll still be wonderful because that means I will eat less and it'll be better for my waistline. And if the food is not spectacular, I'm going to be paying more attention to your words of wisdom, which will make you feel better. So our relationship in this bad meal will probably improve. So the point is that events don't cause stress. Our views of events cause the stress. The more mindful you are, the more you recognize that any event, any object, any person can take multiple views. Why choose the one that's going to make you miserable? Yeah. You get to talk now.
The thing with all this is this feels very logic-based. And like you can tell this to someone that's like just perennially a pessimist, and they're like clinging to certainty because it's probably rooted in some kind of fear-based something. Maybe like my perception would be like, oh, this is like probably childhood stuff. There's like trauma here. There's something that's like deep that amount of logic is going to get you to suddenly just start changing your language and start seeing the bright side of everything.
How does a person start to really get in there? We have three groups of people. There are those who say, yeah, I know that. She's right. And then you have the group of people who, you know, well, maybe, and maybe I'll try it. And then you have the people, no way. So let's get the first two groups on board, and a large number will help persuade the naysayers. But how do you get into it? Test it. You know, that ask yourself, when people are stressed, they're saying something bad is going to happen. How might that be good? There's no way it can be good, right? You know, you're not that smart then. There's always some way. Think of the way it can be good. Now, I had experiences, one that was very dramatic, and I think, I'm not suggesting people have this experience, but for me, it's been wonderful, let me tell you. My house burned down. So 80% of what I owned was burned. Now, I had to then move to a hotel to live. This was Christmas. I went out Christmas Eve. When I got back to the room, it was full of gifts. Not gifts from the owner of the hotel or the management, gifts from the so-called little people, the people who parked my car, the chambermaids who cleaned the room, the waiters and waitresses. It was beautiful, Aaron. And I don't remember anything I lost in that fire. But every Christmas, I remember this. And it makes me feel good about people in general, worth more than any of the items I might have lost. So that's in a big way, you know, maybe for people to take an event from the past, which is easier to play with than something that's raw, you know. So if the person you're madly in love with leaves you, you know, at that moment, you're not going to be open to, weren't that happy anyway.
This could be like the you and me and the date analogy, if we're still running the analogy.
Yeah, am I leaving you or are you leaving me?
I don't know. You can leave me. It's fine. I think you would dump me.
No. I don't dump people. I find the good in everyone.
Oh, wow. That's true. Yeah. That could be an issue.
You don't want me to, right? You want it to be just you. No one is like you.
I think they call it Stockholm syndrome.
All right. I'm not going to go there. Anyway. So, you know, but it is true that, we can move some of these people who you think are steeped in the negative and don't want to learn about any other way of being.
It'll make them irritated. Tell them something like this, they're going to say,
maybe, but I
don't want to hear it, bro. My house burnt down. F off.
Okay. Yes. For the big ones, but
or whatever. No. Someone's just generally a cunt. Like, and they just operate in that kind of operating system. In my experience, one of the worst things you could suggest to them is like, hey, just look at the bright side. Your words are powerful, blah, 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 blah.
I'm not going against
what you're saying. I'm just saying is like, what about the hard cases of this? And what about the hard cases within myself?
I agree.
I agree with you.
Aaron, let's just put the hardest case aside, and if they want to be miserable,
all right.
But I don't want people to belittle this work by saying, I'm telling everyone to be positive. That's not what I'm telling anyone. What I'm saying is that any situation can be understood in multiple ways. To see it in a single way gives you no choice and is mindless. Once you open it up, the just opening it to multiple perspectives, you end up feeling better. And then choose whatever way whichever of these perspectives you want to follow, knowing that it's not more or less likely than all these other understandings. I mean, so let's say you don't like me because I'm gullible. That's because from my perspective, I'm trusting. I don't like you because you're inconsistent. That's because from your perspective, you're flexible. Every single negative ascription has a positive alternative. So once we teach this person that, several things happen, even with the hard nose. You know, you really can't stand me because I'm so damn gullible. And once you see that I'm trusting, you're going to like me more. And I'm going to say, well, you want me to change? Do you want me to become distrusting? And you're going to say, no. Do I want you to be less flexible? No. And even with the hard nose, relationships will improve. And you get there by recognizing that things change, that people, even if the person is a hard nose, they're not a hard nose across all situations. And from their perspective, there's some advantage to being that way.
And if you're annoyed by that person, like I could be by like said, cuntly person that's just pessimistic, angry, runs on stress.
And you enjoy being like that. No, sure.
If a person doesn't want to change, or my perception or projection of them is they don't want to change, my reframe to at least create some ease within myself would be like, oh, they're incredibly stable.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is something that's that could be a solution into softening that person.
Because they're not fighting with you trying.
You reduce the fight, then that could disarm a little bit and we could start to be able to create change.
Perfect. It sounds like you've taken all of my courses and you've had personal therapy with me.
We're going to team up, Ellen Leger.
Why not? Is it before or after that fancy dinner? Or it's the second dinner we'll that you're see. Paying for?
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
But let me go back to something that's kind of fun. You know, as I said, that there are lots of personal stories in the book. And one that I use in the decision-making chapter, which we didn't talk about decision-making, I just said prediction is difficult. And when you know you can't predict, then obviously deciding becomes a different matter. But there are other reasons why you can't predict. I mean, why decisions, it doesn't make difference what decision you make. Before I get to that, remind me. So I had this experience with Hell's Angels, and it was terrifying. I'm not going to give away the punchlines, but as I tell the story, I stop and I simply ask, what would you do? See, after the fact, you can say, oh, I did the right thing, or God, was I stupid for doing. But as you're going along, it all makes sense. And in the same way, every decision we make is the right decision. But people don't realize that. They think they should be doing cost-benefit analyses without realizing every cost is also a benefit, as we just said. So if you're both rigid and consistent, flexible and inconsistent and so on, you can't add these things up to know whether you should go take this alternative or that, right? You want to meet my friend Susie? She's very inconsistent. No. You want to meet my friend Susie? She's very flexible. Sure. Okay, so then do you want to meet? I don't know. And since we can't know, and for many other reasons, the bottom line, and people have to read the book to be persuaded how this makes full sense, but it's freeing, is rather than spend time trying to make the right decision, we should make the decision right.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that.
That will put out of business lots of decision theorists, but so be it.
That's, I think, a really powerful tool for all form of relationship, including just relationship with yourself, your crews around the world, noticing things. And I would imagine that would be something like a new pathway that would need to be cultivated or like myelinated, to use like Harvard speak. I would think that it would be a repetitious, routinized process of saying, my previous inclination is to be like, screw that person. I'm angry. I go into this cortisol response and jack myself up in this fight flight state. I'm able to be the observer of that. And I'm gonna actually put in a repetition of another way to turn it around. And I would imagine that that would become something that would actually become like an incredibly invaluable skill to cultivate. Is that like a reasonable way to
yeah, I think it? So. I think it doesn't have to be quite so fancy. If you simply,
I'm compensating because you're so smart, Ellen.
I see, but
I feel small beside you.
Oh, please. And if I bought that, okay. No, I do buy it, and I feel sorry for you, and we'll talk about it when we get off.
Get off.
No, I think people just need to recognize that when somebody is doing something, it makes sense to them or else they wouldn't do it, right? Yeah. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, today I'm going to be an idiot. I'm going to be clumsy. I'm going to be inconsistent. So when you see them, before you ascribe these things to them, what were they intending? And then you can see from that how relationships clearly improve. And as your relationships yourself, you know, why did I do that? You know, so if we really were involved, which would be ridiculous because I'm so much younger than you are, but
if 2023, baby,
that's it. Okay. That if we, were involved, you wouldn't hear me say, I'm sorry. Not because I'm against saying I'm sorry. I mean, you'd hear me saying it, but essentially I'm not going to feel bad because you know, I know that I did what I did for some good reason, and sometimes things don't work out, you know, and then you'd just give me a chance to tell you why I forgot to call you when I was supposed to, or why I ordered the wrong thing for you, or whatever nonsense occurred. Most of the arguments that people have are reasonably petty. And I think if they just started off with each other saying, well, first, do you believe that I love you? And if the person says, yes, then the rest of it is easy. You know, then they know that there must be some good reason. But
yeah, maybe also you're learning to love. Not that we're going to get into like a relationship conversation, but I think that's a big part as well. It's like having some empathy for a person in their journey. You know, it's like how much
where they are in
that process.
I think that as a culture, as a world, is no different from us as individuals. That right now people are trying to solve today's problems with yesterday's solutions. And when we open that up and people are more mindful, all of us become a bit more humble. And, you know, in fact, I did this study that where we've had musicians, this will be relevant in a moment, or you'll have forgotten why it's not, either way. But we had musician orchestras playing mindfully or mindlessly. So when they were mindful, they were told, make it new in very subtle ways. When they were mindless, just replicate a past performance they liked. We record the performance, play it for people. They overwhelmingly prefer the mindfully played piece. Okay, good. When I started writing this up, I was oblivious to what became so interesting to me was that here you had a situation where people's coordinated effort was enhanced by everybody doing their own thing. You would think it would be cacophonous, especially in a music setting, right? Everybody be mindful. They're noticing everybody is there and they're all there for the same present situation. And so that led me to think that the job of the leader is not to use yesterday's solutions to solve today's problems, not to think they know, not to reprimand those whose behavior they're misunderstanding, but simply to provoke each other's mindfulness. And on the individual level, and that's why we would get along so well after I hit you over the head a few times, Aaron, because you know, I would let my mindfulness lead to your mindfulness, which we have another set of studies. There's no time to tell you about them, but essentially we find that mindfulness is contagious in two ways. One, where you would expect it, you know, that we have people who are interacting with kids who are autistic. When the person is mindful, the autistic child behaves just like the normal child. Because they're hypersensitive to other people's consciousness. We have a wine tasting study where the experimenter is, and these was with heavy drinkers as the participants, when the experimenter is mindful or mindless, and we see how much the person drinks. And when the person is with a mindless experimenter, they drink more because being around people who are mindless, you know, is a turnoff. So when people are mindful, you trust them, they seem authentic, you feel safe. And so you can see how relationships would unfold. The other way, which is really woo-woo, but I put it in the book anyway because it's just, you know, who knows if this will hold up over time. Just by being next to somebody mindful, not talking, not them encouraging you, not them winking at you, just being with somebody who's mindful seems to make you more mindful. It's wild.
Totally. Yeah, totally. We're attuning to each other. Yeah. Or, I mean, yeah. that's like called rapport building. Yeah. Not to like belittle it, but that's like when we're communicating to another person, we're going to start to match tonality, match pacing of language, match facial gestures.
Yeah, except in this case here, people are not looking at each other and they're not talking to each other.
I want to take a moment and share a free resource with y'all to sort out your movement that is starting the first free week of the Align Method online program, where you get a thorough movement assessment to establish what is your personal movement baseline. And then on top of that, we share fundamental mobility techniques that will make a massive difference in your own personal practice. If you do any type of stretching or yoga or foam rolling or resistance band training or training in general, you want to get the most out of your body. These are must-know mobility techniques. And then it finishes with a sit rise challenge, so you can test yourself and see how effectively you get up and down off of the ground. That is the first week of the Align Method online program. It's a 6-week program. You can start the first week at alignpodcast.com/AMP. And with that, you will also join the free Align community, where there's over 3,000 other members in there. So I pop in there each day, totally free. The first week is totally free. And then if you don't love the idea of continuing on with the 6-week program, then you can cancel anytime. So check us out over at alignpodcast.com/AMP. I want to take a moment and share something that has been invaluable to my own personal healthcare. That is getting my blood work done and checking my specific biomarkers with LifeForce. They're incredible because they have at-home phlebotomists. They come to you, which that's one of the biggest pain in the butts for me, is like going and getting my blood somewhere. I don't want to do that. And then shortly after that, you get your results back and you can see exactly what is happening with you in their very easy to use user interface. Then you set up a call. It's absolutely free, or it's a part of the membership, to speak with one of their functional medicine doctors. The gal that I talked to was incredible. I asked her every question I possibly could, and she had amazing answers for everything. And then they offer you suggestions based off of your specific blood work, what is happening with you specifically, which is so important. I can't emphasize that enough. And they go over lifestyle suggestions, they go over nutritional suggestions, and then offer nutraceuticals as well as peptide therapy and hormone therapy if that is something that is supportive for you. That is all stuff that you can talk to with them to see if that would be something that would make sense for you. I would always go for the low-hanging fruit first, make sure that you are adjusting your lifestyle and your nutrition first. And then on top of that, there are some things that sometimes it can be very supportive to start to supplement in an exogenous way. So these guys are fantastic. I've had an amazing experience. Their membership is just, it's something that's been invaluable in my life, just to remove all of the guesswork from my nutrition as well as some lifestyle choices, make sure my sleep is good, make sure everything that I'm putting into my body is on point. And they're also measuring for optimization, not just average baseline. So I love these guys. I think they're invaluable. I think you guys will dig them. And you can get $200 off of your membership by going to mylifeforce.com/align. That's mylifeforce.com/align. I implore anyone, get your blood work done, see what's happening with you, get a bird's eye view of your health, and then start moving from there. mylifeforce.com/align. You guys are going to dig them.
What do you think of collective consciousness? What do you think of the power of, is there some tipping point with the whole world starts to believe that we can all live to age 150?
Yeah.
It becomes true, things of that sort.
Okay, well, I certainly believe that we'll be able to live beyond 150. You know, that I just saw something, a picture of this woman who made herself a birthday cake. Somebody sent this to me, and she is 112. right? Now, the younger generation is already expected, newborns now are already expected to live to 125. And if you can live to 125, why not 126? And then 126, you know, and so on.
Yeah.
So that I don't, I think that that will happen. I hope, and the reason I keep writing these books and giving these talks, not just to meet nice people like yourself, but to make it so, to encourage the spread of this mindfulness and to hope we're in the midst of an evolution in consciousness. And then it'll just be a better world for all of us. You know, when you think about it, there's enough food for everybody. You know, we don't have to have people who are starving. The multi-billionaires can't spend all that money. The reason they want all that money, I would imagine, is for bragging rights or, you know, to have a positive image of themselves, which they could have, you know, without any of that money if they'd only listen to people like us.
Could it become a barrier to them actually encountering that?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And it also could become a facilitator because they realize they're still not any happier and they have to actually figure something out.
Yeah.
But it could go a lot of different directions, but it's not the money.
Right, exactly. But maybe you'll help me in this endeavor. I want to take the vertical, so where I, you, others sit on top, and make it horizontal. Make it so everybody is appreciated. So I wrote this song for my grandkids. I'm not going to sing it, although I should sing it because the essence of a song is why should I can do a lot of things. The fact that I can't
sing it. What are you doing?
I'm not going to sing it now. I've embarrassed myself. But the idea is that everybody doesn't know something and everybody knows something else. Everybody can't do something and everybody can do something else. And, you know, we got a glimpse of it during COVID when the people you cared most about were the ones who were willing to deliver the toilet paper, you know, not your accountant or the architect. And we lost it too quickly. But this is so important to me. And I was at the house. We were getting a giant delivery to store some things in the basement. And I felt, and I've got these, you know, 3 Distinguished Scientist Award, Genius Award, you know, awards up the wazoo, wherever the wazoo is. And I say to myself, there's no way that all of that furniture is going to fit in this space where you're going to actually be able to have access to it. And the guy who is here, who helps at my partner's store, who thinks nothing of himself and he's uneducated and, you know, somebody who thinks of himself as a loser. Okay, so here I am, the big winner. There he is, the big loser. He puts it all in the basement and you can access anything there. It was perfect. And it just felt to me so unfair. You know, here his talents so outweighed mine. Why should my praise be sung and he walk away feeling, you know, so bad for himself? And so I've got new views of how to totally change our system of education. In the Mindful Body book, I have how to create a new system of hospitals, what the hospital should be. And I think that in making believe, this is all an answer to your question, that yes, over the next, how many years did you say, 50 years? Many of these changes will take place. And I, at 76, expect to be around to see them.
I love that. Yeah, it's the, what do they call it? I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's the longevity escape velocity. Are you familiar with that?
No.
It's the concept is essentially if you're at a certain age and a certain health, then every day that you're around, technology is advancing.
Yes, and exactly.
So you can make it. Whereas if you're like 90 and again, whatever, it's like technology is not going to be good enough in the next before you die. But if you're younger and you keep yourself healthy, you can kind of hang on that edge and kind of wait for technology to catch up. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, interesting that's thing. Fun.
Yeah, it's a good time. Yeah, the titles thing is interesting as well. And this isn't a question. Then I think I do have a question behind this, but it made me start thinking about lobsters and crabs back in colonial times, were perceived as like cockroaches.
Yeah, and they were enormous. They were 25-pound lobsters that people wouldn't eat. Today they'd kill for them. Yeah.
Today they kill for them. Right. Today it's this regal thing. You know, today if you're a football player, you're praised by everyone. It's an amazing thing. What the fuck are you actually doing?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, but if you're but if you're a plumber, it's like, oh, it's not the sexiest job. But you know, it's just I don't really have a comment on that other than it's just interesting the way that we prize certain
well,
positions.
But you see, to me, but that's relevant to everything that I write about, because as long as if you can generate a few of those instances, it's very freeing. You know, that to know, to if you want to do something and you don't think people will approve of it, but you say to yourself, well, maybe people in the future will approve of it, it's freeing then to let yourself go do it. You know, all the people who are in the closet who wouldn't let themselves experience the relationships that they wanted because society was so much against it. And then you have now people so open to such things. And I teach young people, and the horse has already left the barn. They don't care. You know, it doesn't matter. He, she, we, they, you know, have whatever kind of relationships you want. It's just not, it's the way it should be. But so, you know, so anything you want to do because you think that it will feel good, possibly be good for you, I think we should just do. I tell my students, you know, when I assign a paper, I say, I don't want to hear silly excuses. If you don't want to write it, don't write it. You know, life is short. And if you're not going to write a paper that's going to be meaningful to you, don't waste my time asking me to read it, and don't waste your time, you know, stealing it from wherever. Now, it wouldn't be much time for them. They just ask ChatGPT-4.
So you all ChatGPT, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Making a lot of the
teachers' lives
education
harder.
System, quite like antiquated. I'm curious your academic perspective on what the hell is happening with something as far-fetched as like morphic resonance, a la Rupert Sheldrake, which is kind of what we're describing. I don't know if you're familiar with. Have you heard of morphic resonance, Rupert Sheldrake stuff?
Oh, well,
it's
I know
like
Sheldrake
the morphic stuff. Feel, the morphic field essentially is what you're describing, where if you're beside someone of a certain disposition, it affects you. Your dog is aware of when you're coming home, even if you come home at a regular time. The dog kind of gets this like I was just thinking about you. What's the academic lens, or is there just no language within academics to be able
no,
to
I don't think there's a language for it yet. You know, that we get closer and closer to these sorts of things. I remember years ago, I was talking about some of my work with somebody who was a Taoist, and, you know, very smart, very aware of lots of the deep beliefs regarding health. And I kept saying, I can't write about that. You know, it's just too far from where people are. And so all of those people that some of us say, yeah, there's something there, you know, that the time will be right where people can open themselves to it. There's work now on synchrony, and we've done some of it, but I haven't published it. But there's old research where...
Synchrony or synchronicity?
Synchronicity. Synchronicity.
Yeah.
Okay, there's old research.
Did you say synchrony?
I might have.
All right. I think I'm just interrupting you unnecessarily.
No, that's okay.
Such an asshole.
My bad. You know, okay, so yes, the genius makes mistakes.
I got you, Ellen.
All right, yeah. I'm pleased to be gotten. Careful, you're going to pay for that dinner. Anyway, there's old research, I think, God, from the 70s, that found that girls in college dormitories would come to menstruate together, you know, at the same time. And
the alpha,
so,
would lead it.
And and so that's not so different from a lot of this. So, I think that everything is going to look very different in not that distant a future. And it's fun to be part of it. I mean, I think all I'm saying to people is, wake up so that you can enjoy some of these things rather than right now. I think too many people are sealed in unlived lives. So maybe the way, you know, what I'm trying to do is help break the seal.
Yeah. I love that. Do you have a hard out? I know that we started late, so I don't want to dip into, you got like life and things to get to. Not that we go forevermore.
No, always. But I mean, at some point, I'm going to be hungry. But other than that, you don't have to worry.
All right, very, very good. Very good. I wanted to ask, I actually had a question, because I reference the counterclockwise study quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's just a really interesting thing. And within that, something that I've kind of come to as a potential variable that would be very hard to measure is just so many people, particularly old people in their 70s, are suffering, I would say, which you could reframe that into something
else.
Yeah,
that's fine.
They're experiencing loneliness, you know, and loneliness is gnarlier for a person's physiology than smoking cigarettes and like all these bad things. And it's just like, it's an issue. If you feel separated, isolated, desolate, alone, like what's my purpose?
Yeah.
It's not good for one's physiology and their health.
Yeah. And good for you when you're 20 years old either.
Any age, right. Yeah. Any age. And okay. I wonder within that, it would be very hard to control for that. But I wonder how much of the effect of just like really absurd benefits on people's health and their dexterity. And I think I remember reading like the length of their fingers even changed. So
that's because their arthritis released
and better circulation and more acute vision and all that stuff. I wonder how much of that could have been not so much because they believed or they were, acting as I was 20 years. I wonder how much is because like purpose, connection,
or social.
We're finally playing. We're using our imagination.
Yeah. Aaron, I have no trouble with that because to me, the major point is that those things that we think only go in one direction from good to bad as you age, you know, you develop when you're a kid, but at some point you start aging and that's when it all falls apart. And I'm saying, no, it just isn't so. It doesn't have to be so. So I don't care how do we explain it. You know, the fact of it is what's most interesting to me. And I'm sure all of those things play a part. And the proof of that is that the comparison group, people who were just reminiscing for that time, also showed improvement, just not as much.
Just less.
Yeah.
They were also engaging in probably less play and less imagination, which leads me to believe that perhaps tapping a person into the dynamic of play could be very intuitive.
And play is simply being mindful. You know, when you do something at play, you don't feel that you're playing unless you're engaged, and you don't feel the desire to be engaged or enjoy play when you're worried about, am I going to win or lose, or people going to laugh at me, or whatever it is that gets to us when we're in a non-play situation. You know, I think that's another thing that I try to do. There's this wonderful video. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Piano Stairs. I love this. So people in, no, I do, you'll hear, people in Scandinavia go down to, and I think they've done it all over now, but go down to subways. Now, in most subways in the world, it turns out, you have an escalator and stairs. So they videotape this, and everybody's taking the escalator. Then they lay down a piano board that actually do as you step on the stair. Now it becomes such fun. Everybody moves from the escalator to the stairs. And all I ask my students or anybody I talk to is, why wait for somebody to lay down the piano? You know, you can do this in your heads. I mean, everything to me is fun. Now, it doesn't mean that if I'm doing some, you know, I'm not performing surgery, but if I were performing surgery, I'd be laughing all the way, you know, whistling while I'm working. But if you don't find it interesting, if you don't find it invigorating, then you're probably doing it mindlessly. And I say, stop. You know, you go to the movies, don't sit and bitch about it for 2 hours. This is what used to happen when I was younger, when people used to go to the movies all the time. I think they're starting to go again. But, you know, they'd walk out and they, oh, it was so terrible. To me, either find a way to make it enjoyable or leave. You know, how could I leave? Yeah. I just spent $10 to get this, which is kind of ridiculous. You spend $10 and waste, you know, 2 hours of your time. Everything can be made fun to be
That's
fun.
Alan Watts has a bit about that. Maybe paraphrasing something along the lines of like the key to life is realizing that work can be play. And when you come to that point where you don't have a differentiation, which is very Cartesian kind of dualistic separation of like I work and then I play. And it's a very unhealthy approach.
Well, so that's why when I write about, some people talk about work-life balance. And I, God, no. I say,
yeah, sounds gross.
No, it should be work-life integration.
Integration.
It should be one thing. And, you know, now somebody would say, well, it's easier for you. You know, it's easy for you because you're running your podcast. You're in the house alone. You know, what trouble are you going to have? And I sit at lofty, you know, 13th floor at William James Hall at Harvard. And many people don't have that option. Still, there's a way of, if there's somebody at work that's making you feel uncomfortable, If it were I would feel sorry for the person that, you know, they think that by pushing me around, that's the only way they can feel worthwhile. I wouldn't let it get to me.
Yeah, there's the opportunity. And then you're also like, that's something that's, you know, there's, I think, pretty decent research around, what would the term be, like compassionate meditation, you know, like extending compassion out to other people is actually, once again, a very supportive practice for one's own physiology. So when someone's being a dick to you, there is always the availability to see the pain within them and see like, oh my God, like you were probably so hurt and I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
And exactly. It's like, wow. Like,
yeah.
Like suddenly you start building up this energy within you.
I had two dogs and I was taking them for a walk and this woman comes racing out of her house in a house coat. There's a leash law in Cambridge. And I looked at her and I said, I'm sorry you're not happy. And she ran back in the house, you know? So when people behave badly, it's usually because they're not happy. So rather than be intimidated by it, I think that your response was indeed nicer than mine, I think. But mine was still nice enough, you know, calling it nice what enough. It was. Nice enough. It's a new criteria.
So we can wrap up, Kurt, because so you can eat and all things. Something that I think is really interesting, the other thing that you say that you conducted was the chambermaid study, I think is how they call it. And so I just want to
I talk about the chambermaid study. It was a second study to test the mind-body unity idea. Do you want me to tell people briefly about it?
Well, so how could, maybe like a brief synopsis of it, but also just how people could start to integrate the principles that you gathered from the chambermaid study into one's own training program or into one's own life when they're walking down the street, like actionable, like how can we start to integrate?
Okay, well, in the chambermaid study, we had this amazing finding. The chambermaids didn't see themselves as exercising, even though that's what they're doing 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And that's because they thought exercise, according to the Surgeon General, is what you do after work. And after work, they're just too tired. So we took these chambermaids, we divided them into two simple groups. One group, all we did was teach them their work was exercise. We showed them making a bed is like working on this machine at the gym and so on. So now we have two groups. It turns out, we go to great lengths to find out that at the end of this, they're not eating any differently, they're not working any harder. All that's changed is their mindset. Now they see their work as exercise. As a result, they lost weight. There was a change in waist to hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came out. So this is all about mind-body unity. And so the takeaway first is that we can accomplish an enormous amount because it's usually our thoughts that are holding us back. As I said, fatigue is in part a psychological concept. When you think that what you're doing is worthless, basically our expectations tend to be fulfilled. You won't gather from it what you might otherwise. That when you're doing your exercise, sure, I mean, this would suggest be aware that you're exercising, but it's much more than that. I think that if you're going to do it, be there. That's the simplest message. Whether you're brushing your teeth, taking a walk, lifting weights, don't do it mindlessly, because when you're mindless, essentially the system is turning itself off and you're hurting yourself. And,
Schwarzenegger would say.
Yeah, oh, really? Well, there Arnold we go. Arnold and I.
That was his, when he was in Pumping Iron, talks about like the mind model, mind muscle connection. You know, and that was one of the things he would like to do is get high. And work out, which I am also a big advocate for. I think cannabis and psilocybin and things of the sort, like I'd be curious your perception of that, because now it's started to become a safe haven for academics to be able to communicate about, whereas 5 years ago, like, oh my God, you couldn't do it. Now it's like, oh yeah, we could talk about that. I wonder your perception on something like psychoactive substances.
I think it's all interesting. I think that if you're doing it for research purposes, that's different from just using the drugs yourself. For me, I don't know how to say this without sounding sort of obnoxious. I'm happy. And I don't need to take something to bring me down, to work me up, to, you know, so on. I don't see any harm in trying all sorts of things. Now, obviously, things like heroin, which I know nothing about, trying it once is going to mean you're not going to be able to keep yourself from trying it again, so then don't try it again. But but I think the more interesting message is that so much of what these drugs enable you to do, you can bring about yourself without the drugs.
And the drugs oftentimes can present the window to be able to see something that was maybe just you didn't have the willpower to go do the 10-day Vipassana or the breath work, or you didn't have the near-death experience thing that suddenly opened your eyes, or you didn't have your heart broken and see a therapist and go through all these different – you were just kind of generally in this dull, kind of banal gray. And you're just – it's like something – you need something to kind of shake your snow globe up. And that's, I'm not suggesting psychedelics, but I'm also like – it's an interesting thing that we have access to different
things. I think that you're right, that all of those things can, quote, shake you out of it. But I think, and maybe it's because I've never seen myself as conservative, but I'm a liberal conservative at this moment, that, you know, reading a book, hearing somebody say, you know, you just get somebody say one thing. You know, to me, when I tell people to ask themselves, is it a tragedy or an inconvenience? They come back to me and they say it was life-changing, because they get crazed with so many things that they know in the long run aren't important. I think that the important thing is don't settle for less than a full, exciting life. And, you know, if we can help people get there, that's great. If their local cannabis store it works for them, who am I to say anything? You know, I'm afraid that those candies, that I would eat them like candy, which, you know.
You got to watch out with edibles. Edibles is a very different thing. It turns into a completely different compound in your body as well. And it can become like a full-blown psychedelic, whereas, you know, vaporizing cannabis or something like that, I think it's generally pretty benign.
Well, I've thought about...
I've
thought about taking some of those before I go to sleep, but then I fall asleep too soon and I don't get to experience it.
I think it's something that is, it should be deeply respected and folks ought to be well educated about it. And a problem happens when something becomes taboo, people become ignorant, and now suddenly we have this very, very powerful tool that can, you know, you can build a house with the tool, or you can, you know, kill somebody with the tool. But it's like, it's like, how do we wield the tool?
Right.
And we live in a culture of very immature people, as broadly speaking, because of, I think, the lack of education around some of those tools. Is my perception, which doesn't associate to this conversation so much. But I really appreciate you. I really enjoy these conversations. Thank you for the laughs.
It's always fun talking to you.
Yeah. So your book, The Mindful Body, comes out September 15th?
September 5th. So it's right around the corner.
Coming around the corner. So we'll release this guy.
It can be pre-ordered right now. And and hopefully your listeners will help me get the message out.
Yeah, we'll get this out. This will go out just after September 5th. So this will be out at the time of folks listening to this. And you're just such a massively important and humble, kind, generous figure in the world, and I'm so grateful to get to share conversations with you. It's really like a meaningful experience for me. You're someone that I've looked up to for many years. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah.
Take care.
Is there anything else you want to point people to, or just grab the Mindful Body?
No. Yeah, just grab the Mindful Body.
Boom. Don't take yourselves. Chill out. Everybody, just chill out.
Yeah, I mean, people should know they should take what they do seriously. None of us should take ourselves so seriously.
Angels fly because they take themselves lightly. I think that's G.K.
I like that. Who said
Chesterton.
That? Oh, really?
Is it G.K. K.G. Chesterton? What's the writer?
I just say Chesterton.
Some letters. Yeah, yes. Whatever.
Isn't there a W in there?
W.K. Chesterton.
Is that it?
I don't know.
Google it. Then write to me and let me know.
All right. Good talk, Ellen.
You do well.
Thank you.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. If you did, jump over to YouTube, subscribe over there so you can see the video version of this and the rest of the podcast, as well as instructional content that is also at Align Podcast on YouTube. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for sharing. Thanks for joining you. I'll see you next week.